What? Well, you know, the important thing about growing older and getting wiser is learning when you shouldn't make a what's Xing my wise joke about a series of profoundly horrific crimes against humanity. And I've grown as a person. So
good job.
We're just going to go into the episode and not think at all about what it is I was going to say before I stopped myself and narrowly avoided cancellation. This is Behind the Bastards, a podcast about the worst people in all of history, of whom I would have been one had I completed the sentence that this introduction was meant to be initially, as it was originally planned. But I didn't, so you motherfuckers can't cancel me. That's right. I'm gonna go.
Unfortunately, this also means that you will never be installed as leader of a country by the CIA.
Don't say never. Don't say never. You never, like, what do you, I mean, anybody, look, a man can dream. Christopher, we're talking more about Manchuria today. We just went through a lot of war crimes. Where are we?
Is it time? Is it time for The Reckoning, as you titled
it?
Yeah.
It is, yeah. Tisha 2, The Reckoning.
Fuck yeah. Spicy. Let's go.
Yeah. So we are back in Japan. We are back in 1945 and we are back in, we are back in the US occupation. And okay. Now I think a pretty natural reaction to seeing the words a US military occupation is to assume that's going to go badly. And it is, but it actually didn't start out that way. And it didn't start out that way because the first phase of the sort of Japanese occupation by the U.S. is run by a bunch of New Dealers. And these guys looked at Japan and were like, okay, so what if instead of fascism, we did the New Deal? And so they do a bunch of stuff that's like really leftist. Like for example, the big one that you could never do in the U.S., they do this huge land reform package where they force all the landlords who own a certain amount of land to like sell it to their tenants. And, you know, it's, there's like 2 years, you know, 1945, 1947, where, you know, the U.S. like is actually kind of trying to make Japan like better and more democratic and less shit. But all of that comes to an end in 1947, basically as a result of the Cold War. And this is called the reverse course. And it signifies basically when American business interests like take control of Japan. And, you know, like in 1950, they do this thing called the Red Purge, where they do this mass firing of like suspected communists and just and anyone who's sort of like vaguely associated with the left just like get fired from their jobs, both in the government and the private sector. This is coordinated.
And if I'm not mistaken, this is kind of around the time when there's also a lot of protests against the American occupiers because a bunch of GIs are raping ladies.
Yeah,
which is another major thing that drives a lot of like the early protests post-war in Japan.
Yeah, they're also just like shooting people, and we'll get more into soldiers just randomly murdering people.
Excellent. But,
you know, I guess actually speaking of soldiers randomly murdering people. So one of the reasons why fascism is never really sort of like crushed in Japan is that the head of G2, which is the Army's intelligence section, is also a fascist. And, you know,
no way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I said, like, this is not me calling Charles A. Willoughby a fascist, though. Like, this guy is going to go on to become like Franco's promoter in Europe. Like MacArthur calls him a fascist.
Wow. MacArthur, yeah, like, the guy who suggested nuking cities in China to win the Korean War. If that dude calls you a fascist, you're probably pretty fucking fashy.
You know, and this is a big issue because Willoughby's job, like the actual job he is there to do is to like just completely obliterate the rest of the Japanese fascist organizations and Japanese fascist societies. And what he does instead is he used the G2's counterintelligence corps to do union busting and staging false flag attacks and blaming them on the Socialist Party. And he does one other thing that's both incredibly important to this story and important to Japanese history. He decides he wants to start negotiating with the Yakuza in order to sort of like use them as a weapon against the left. And in order to
do this.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. You can see where this is going. He goes.
I mean, versions
to,
of this happen in Italy with the mafia too, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, the Italian mafia is interesting because every once in a while they like will back a leftist. Like, that's like how the sort of weird Red Brigade stuff happened. But like,
right.
The Yakuza, they're just fascist. Like, there's no.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
For them.
Yeah. It's great. And yeah. And so Willoughby goes to Tsukumo prison, which is like this is the giant war criminal prison where the U.S. is holding all the war criminals. And he meets with Kishi's cellmate. Now, Kishi's cellmate is a guy named Kodama Yoshio, who's like a giant Yakuza boss. He's involved in the drug trade. He was also arrested for his part in the incredibly named League of Blood incident in 1932, which is this giant like fascist plot to just assassinate a bunch of business owners and liberal politicians. And, you know, so he gets arrested for, this is 1932, and he gets arrested and then he gets released. And then, you know, because again, the Japanese Empire is just a giant cartel with like a state attached to it. He spends the entire war as Japan's like procurement guy, which means that he's running around like basically trading heroin for like tungsten, radium guns and like other stuff to fight the war. And so Willoughby meets with this guy because he also, you know, he still has a bunch of Yakuza connections and he has like $175 million that he made from the war just like on him. And so Willoughby cuts a deal with Kodama that's like, okay, I'll get you out of war crimes jail if you become an American intelligence asset. And Kodama's like, this is just all wins. And so Kodama like immediately like basically reforms this like, I guess you call it like the United Front of like crime and fascism. It's like it's this group, it's this association of like 400 right-wing like fascist and criminal organizations that Kodama just like runs. And, you know, he's going to spend the next 30 years basically just running Japanese politics from the shadows and being basically like the Yakuza's politics guy. Now, how Kishi escaped the noose in 1948 is the subject of some debate. Like, so the U.S. doesn't charge him with the sex slavery crimes or like the forced labor crimes. What he's charged with is violating like crimes against the peace, which is like starting an offensive war. But like even that, even if you just stick to that, like he is the guiltiest man in human history. Like he signed the declaration of war against the U.S. Like easiest conviction ever. Like,
yeah, that really also ought to, like, just as a rule, if you're like someone else who lives in that country and a guy is like, hey, I want to continue being influential. You know me. I'm the guy who helped declare war in the U.S. You would think that, like, everyone would be like, well, we shouldn't be listening to anything you say.
Yeah, you would.
That didn't go very well.
You would think. And, you know, I've seen some stories that talk about, like, some sort of like group of American businessmen interceded on his behalf. I don't know how reliable that is. The other explanation, and this is true regardless of exactly what happened to Kishi, is that like the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal just kind of gave up like trying to actually prosecute people because it was too much work and it was like the Cold War was happening and they just didn't care anymore. And so they do just like a bunch of absolutely half-assed proceedings. And, you know, they rush like Tojo to the gallows and a few people, other people they wanted to kill. And then everyone else just goes free. And so on Christmas Eve 1948, Nobusuke Kishi, the man who enslaved Manchuria and ran the fascist war machine, walked out of prison. And because his brother, future Prime Minister Sato Isaku, is the cabinet chief secretary, Kishi is immediately driven to the Prime Minister's house. He's immediately driven to Prime Minister's house where he trades his prison oranges for a business suit and utters the immortal words, quote, well, I guess we're all Democrats now.
Oh, God. Ew. Ew. Oh, good. Yeah. Ew. Gross. Yeah. Not good. Bad. Not cool or good. Ew.
And thus, Nobusuke Kishi, arch-fascist bureaucrat, entered the new world of electoral politics.
Oh, God. That's
you
depressing.
Love to see it. Yeah, it's like if Wernher von Braun had run for Congress.
Yep. As
opposed to just running NASA.
Yeah. And, you know, okay, so initially he starts putting together basically like the old fascist base. So like he gets some small business owners. He gets some like old school 1931 like fascist terrorists. Yeah. He gets his friends at Nissan are like, yeah, we loved this Manchuria shit. Like we're giving him all of our money. And the other, you know... One of the other, like, very disturbing things about what happened after the war is that, so, you know, I talked to the last episode, Kishi founds this thing called the Ministry of Munitions, which is just, like, the super ministry that does all this planning stuff. And basically all of his old, like, fascist reform bureaucrat buddies who are in the Ministry of Munitions keep their jobs, and the ministry just turned into the Ministry of International Trade and Industry. And, you know, and MITI is the core of Japanese post-war development. And it's, you know, it's all the old fascist shit that Kishi was doing before, except The difference is that it's now being used to sort of like it's being used to fuel the American war machine in Korea and Vietnam instead of fueling the Japanese war machine also in Korea and Vietnam. So, yeah, this is purging the fascists is going well. And when I say going well, I mean in 1952, the U.S. just like gave up any semblance of trying to get rid of fascism and just unpurged everyone they'd purged.
We pardoned a lot of them. We gave the others jobs.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and the interesting thing with Kishi, so the prime minister at the time is Yoshida Shigeru, who was like, this is not a good guy. Like he was also a fascist before the war. But he tells the Americans, do not unpurge this guy. Like, do not unpurge Kishi. And it's extremely funny because, you know, as I mentioned last episode, like, Yoshida is related to Kishi. Like, you remember that uncle that Kishi really liked who, like, raised him for a little bit?
Yeah.
So that guy's daughter, like, is Yoshida's wife. Like, they know each other. Like, Kishi knows this guy's family. And he's still just like, do not do this. Do not let this guy come back into politics. And the U.S. is just like, no, fuck it. Well, he's back. Yeah, Kishi's back.
He'll be fine.
Yeah. And, you know, so Kishi.
You may not have heard of us. We're the United States.
Yeah.
We don't think things through.
Nope. Well, I mean, you know, I would say this works out great for the U.S.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Hooray.
Yeah. It's great. And, you know, and Kishi runs this electoral federation thing in 1952, and it just gets like destroyed. Like, because 1952, everyone's like, we don't like this guy. And I mean, he has a lot of money. He has like hundreds of millions of yen. And so they get like whacked. And so Kishi starts like wheeling around the political scene going, okay, like, what can I latch on to? And like, he almost joins the right wing of the Socialist Party, which would have been the single weirdest pivot I've ever seen in my life. But his brother convinced him to join the ruling sort of center-right liberal party instead. And, you know, like, this is Yoshida's party, and Yoshida, like, doesn't like Kishi, but the liberal party is also falling apart, so he's like, okay, we need Kishi's support. And so in 1953, Kishi joins the party and wins a seat in the Diet. Now, Yoshida's getting help from a lot of places in that election, because 1953 is the first post-war election after the American occupation. And if you know anything about elections that happen in fascist countries immediately after the end of World War II, you know that Yoshida is being backed by the CIA.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And, yeah. If you know anything that happened about elections that happened in these countries after World War II, you know that they didn't.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting because it's like, I think this story is weirder than like the Italian stories. Like, you know, and this, I mean, you know, I guess so the way this is funded is that at the beginning of the Korean War, like, the U.S. needed a bunch of tungsten, and American intelligence basically was like, we need to keep the Socialist Party from literally ever taking power, like, at all costs. And so they talked to Kodama, who's that Yakuza guy from before the war, who Willoughby had, like, broken out of jail, and they get him to smuggle a bunch of tungsten that had been left over from Japan's World War II stockpiles to the U.S., and then they pay him $10 million, and the CIA throws in $2.8 million of their own, and that money is, like, that money is how the Liberal Party, like, wins 1953 elections.
Cool.
It's great.
I mean,
it's gonna get worse.
That seems fine. I bet we did good stuff with all that tungsten.
Yeah, we absolutely bombed the shit out of Korea.
It didn't get fired into multiple countries.
Yep.
Worth of civilian.
It's great.
Okay. Anyway, great. We all. Yeah.
Now, yeah. So you know, Kishi gets elected as part of the Liberal Party, but you know, Kishi is a backstabbing son of a bitch. And he immediately turns on Yoshida and, like, starts denouncing him. Yoshida kicks him out of the party, but Kishi's able to get this, like, breakaway faction to join him, and he forms something called the Democratic Party. And through a lot of incredibly complicated electoral bullshit, like, they're able to oust Yoshida as prime minister. And then Kishi has this giant plan to, like, reunify the two wings of reunify the two wings of the right. There's like his wing is Democratic Party, and then there's the Liberal Party, and he has to reunify them. And the reason he wants to do this is because he wants to control it. But the reason it actually happens is that the Socialist Party had split in like 1948 or something. In 1955, they come back together. And that just like freaks all the conservatives out. And they're like, okay, fine. Like we'll join this new party. And the new party they form is called the Liberal Democratic Party. Now, this is important. The reason I spent so much time talking about this is that the LDP is the single most important party in Japanese politics. In the 66 years since they were founded in 1955, the LDP has been out of power for six. They were in power for the other six.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. This is Japan is almost a one-party state. Yeah, yeah. It's unbelievable. And, you know, and this is Kishi's party. Like, he is the guy who single-handedly built this party. This party would not exist if Kishi had not gone into the Liberal Party, like, tore them apart and then forced them to join his breakaway faction. And, you know, like, he's the reason why it exists. And this party, like, this is the party that's the basis of the entire modern Japanese political system.
Cool.
And yeah, it's great. Kishi, you know, he makes himself the general secretary of the party and wins, you know, in his first election, he wins an absolute majority in the Diet for the LDP. But, you know, instead of becoming prime minister himself, he spends his time sort of biting, like, sort of building up American support for him. Now, you know, we talked about the CDP, I mean, the CIA had been heavily involved with the Liberal Party, and they've been heavily involved with the Liberal Democratic Party, like, from the start. I mean, this is from a New York Times article. "We financed them," said Alfred C. Ulmer Jr., who ran the CIA's Far East operations from 1955 to 1958. "We depended on the LDP for information." He said the CIA had used the payments both to support the party and recruit informants from it from its earliest days. And so the CIA, like, they're working with the LDP on, like, a candidate-by-candidate basis. Like, the CIA has their own electoral guys, and the electoral guys will, like, go to a candidate and go, "We need you to win this seat," and they'll, like, personally hand them money. And so, you know, this is where you get the first of the Dolas brothers entering the sort of political arena.
Hell yeah.
And then I still let you before this. In 1955, you also get the second Dulles brother, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, who, mm-hmm. like, basically straight up 1955 is like the liberal, like, he's like tells the Japanese, like, the Liberal Party will unify with the Democratic Party, and, like, if you don't, like, vague threat insert here. And so John Foster Dulles, directly responsible in many ways, both the Dulles brothers are responsible for Kishi, like, forming the most important political party in the history of Japan. And all of this ends with Kishi becoming prime minister in 1957. And he just immediately starts doing crime. So
what else are you going to do? For sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, this Kishi's like Kishi's an incredible money launderer from his time in Manchuria. Like, you know, and he devises a scheme to, like, make some money off of the reparations payments that Japan had to pay to, like, the countries that it invaded after the war. And so he basically, what he does is he negotiates to have these reparations payments, like, paid in Japanese goods and services. And so he buys those Japanese goods and services with state money from his own corporate political allies. And then, it's great. It's great. He's using the reparations payment to, like, pay off his, like, fascist buddies. And then he does the exact same thing to, like, the Japanese foreign aid, like, projects. It's also all just Kishi's, like, buddies paying themselves. And, you know, Kishi, he also, like, he develops this system of, like, so Kishi, like, constantly rotates through cabinets in the time that he's prime minister, like, constantly. And the reason he's doing this is because it's basically a way to buy off his political allies. So, like, you know, you give an ally a cabinet minister, and then they get a loot a bunch of money. And then once they've taken enough money, you put in the next person, you put in the next person, you put in the next person. And, you know, he's also just, like, he's not only doing this with like, sort of politicians and, like, businessmen. He's doing this with the Yakuza. So what if the you know, he makes, like a sworn Yakuza guy, like, his Ministry of Agriculture. And then there's the wonderfully named Bambuko Ono, who Kishi...
That is a, like, cool name.
Yeah, it's amazing. Kishi makes this guy the Secretary General of the Liberal Democratic Party. And he stays in that position until Ono dies in 1965. And Ono is wonderful because he gives a speech to 2,000 Yakuza members in the 60s where, like, he just straight up says, like, "Yeah, I'm Yakuza, but I do it by being a politician instead of being a criminal." It's like, it rules. And so, and, you know, the other thing that's happening is that Kishi's still, you know, Kishi's connected to sort of Kodama, and Kodama's, like, whole, like, Yakuza American intelligence network. And so when Lockheed Martin is trying to get the Japanese Defense Force to buy their, like, F-104 Starfighter over Northrop Grumman's F-11F, their guy in Japan, who just happens to be an old G2 intelligence guy, is like, "I know a guy." And the guy that he knows is Kodama, who he pays, like, millions of dollars in bribes to. Is like, they give him, like, a $600,000 commission on every plane they sell to get this sold to the Japanese government. And so Kodama goes to his Yakuza connections in the government, which is, you know, his Yakuza buddy and newly mentioned LDP Secretary General Bamako Ono and his good friend Nobusuke Kishi. And Kishi buys the Starfighter, and Lockheed just, like, keeps Kodama on retainer for, like, the next 30 years. And you know, I want to give people a sense of like how embedded this like intelligence fascist Yakuza network is in the LDP, because it's not like this is a thing that's only Kishi and it goes away. Like in the 1970s, Kodama gets hired again by Locky to do exactly the same thing. And he pays out like several million dollars in bribes. Like he bribes the prime minister again. And this time he gets caught and, you know, he took so much money from like the Americans bribing people that like he managed to piss off both the far right and the far left. And so, you know, they start protesting his house. And on May 23rd, 1976, a fascist porn star named Misua Maneo, who'd been a huge Kodama fanboy, rents
boy,
a
that
plane.
Shouldn't exist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's going to get better. So see, he rents a plane. He like circles Kodama's house, like shouting pro-imperial slogans into a microphone. And then like he screams bonsai and flies the plane into his house. Like this is in 1976. Kodama's
that's
house is
kind of rad, to be honest. That's you know what? You got to give it up sometimes. That critical support. Very cool. Undeniably
though,
rad move.
But Kodama lives through this.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, but does he really?
A guy kamikaze in his house in 1970s, like a fascist porn star kamikaze his house, and he lived through it. It's just, that's yeah, incredible. I mean, that is basically the end of him in politics, but it's like, it's great. It's great.
That is a flex.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a profoundly fascist party with profoundly fascist people in it. And so back in 1957, Kishi's dealing with like his first real political scandal, which is that on January 30th, 1957, a U.S. soldier named Girard, like basically just for fun, shot an empty grenade cartridge out of a grenade launcher at a Japanese woman who was like collecting shell casings at a military base sell for scrap, and she dies.
Oh God.
Yeah. And you know, and this pisses off everyone in Japan. And you know, I mean, especially it's revealed later, she's a mother of six, and everyone just loses their mind. And there's this huge fight over it. And Eisenhower wants to like try him in an American court. And Eisenhower like is literally forced to like try him in a Japanese court, because like if he tried to do it in an American court, like people would have literally like brick by brick dismantled every American military base in the islands. And so Kishi's main concern here is that this is going to like fuck up his political stuff. And so he develops this plan, and he's going to go to Eisenhower and make a bunch of demands about this U.S.-Japan security treaty. Mm-hmm. And this is like one of the other things that's been causing protests, is that this treaty is like, it's signed in 1951 originally, and it's really weird. Like, it lets the U.S. like send troops into Japan to put down, quote, internal riots or disturbances, which is, yeah, there's, and the other, like, in terms of like a peace treaty, and the other thing is it lets the U.S. involve itself in civil wars. And like, you know, a bunch of Japanese commentators point out, like, there's like no precedent for this. Like, there's never been a peace treaty that like between two free nations that allows this. So, you know, and you get these massive protests, like people like build giant wooden fortresses and man them for like 40 years in the middle of American artillery ranges. Like there's all of this stuff. And, you know, Eisenhower meets with Kishi and is like, and Kishi just goes like, you have to revise this treaty. And Eisenhower is like, okay. And so Kishi like stakes basically his entire political career on revising this U.S.-Japan security treaty, which becomes known as Anpo. And, you know, like it really looks like he's going to like pull this off. He's going to get treaty revisions. He's going to be incredibly popular, until Kishi just got like that extra bit too fascist. And the extra bit too fascist was he tried to pass something called the Police Duties Execution Law.
Ooh,
which
that
is like
sound good. That yeah, like is, that's that just already seems like we're on a bad start.
Yeah, yeah. Like this is a police law so fascist that like his other fascist hardliner buddies like in the LDP are like, we won't let you pass this because you'll get eaten alive. Yeah, it basically like what it does is it lets the Japanese, it would have let the Japanese police do warrantless searches and seizures.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and you know, and everyone's like, okay, so this is just like this is pre-war fascism again. So, you know, mm-hmm. And I think he thinks he can get away with this because he's done a bunch of other like fascist culture war mm-hmm. sort of stuff. Like he does this thing where he makes everyone take these like moral lessons, and like all the students take like moral lessons, and has these like evaluations of teachers because he thinks there's like they're too communist and wants fascist propaganda like taught instead. And you know, I want to make it clear, there is no parallel between this and anything that is happening in the U.S. right now. Go back to sleep. There's nothing here. Everything's going to be fine. It's like, yeah, no one in the U.S. is raging a bunch of political campaigns about what teachers are teaching in school because they think it's too leftist.
No, that has not happened. But you know what does happen in the U.S.?
Products and services?
That's right. That's God willing, the only thing that will ever happen in this country in the future going forward. Because when you get right down to it, what else do we need? But products, services, and of course, the blissful, gooey, moist, sticky,
what?
Cum-drenched
Robert,
product
fuck off.
Of products
Stop it.
And services.
Stop it.
What?
Stop
oh,
it.
Okay.
Stop it.
Well, let's just go to ads.
Gosh.
Ah, we're back. Okay. Chris, please continue.
Yes, Chris, please continue.
Sophie's angry at me because she doesn't like it when I say cum-drenched while leading into an ad.
Not at all. I don't think anybody enjoyed that. And if you did, please don't tell us.
I think our sponsors enjoy it, Sophie.
Oh, no.
All right.
I mean, it could be Nissan. We could be getting sponsored by Nissan this episode.
That's fair. Yeah, it could be Nissan.
Absolutely inappropriate.
It could, in fact, be Nissan.
Mm-hmm.
So Kishi's gotten a bit too fascist. And he does this thing where, so the way that like the norms of the Japanese political system worked was that like, you're supposed to, before you pass a bill, you're supposed to talk to the opposition about it. And then there's supposed to be a debate. And Kishi's just like, yeah, fuck that. Like, he just like snap introduces it without like, he takes a snap vote to extend the diet and just like snap forces everyone to try to vote on it. And this is like maximally bad politics by Kishi. Like, you know, I say it's like the norms of democracy are like actually important to Japan, and they're important because this is a country that was a decade and a half ago literally fascist. And Kishi's trying to pass this bill that is bring fascism back. And so, you know, everyone gets pissed off. Like, three of his cabinet ministers resign. And this also pulls the whole left together. And they form something called the People's Council. And they start a general strike, drop the bill, and Kishi, and, you know, and they win. And Kishi's forced to pull the bill, and it, you know, it makes him way weaker politically. And when he tries to get his security, like Anpo, the security treaty ratified by the Diet, those same groups form this even larger group called the People's Council for Preventing Revision of the Security Treaty. And this thing is massive. It's got 134 different organizations in it. You know, the biggest of them are the Japanese Socialist Party, the General Council of Trade Unions in Japan, who are a very powerful trade union federation. And then there's Zengokuren, which is the Japanese radical student movement, who we will talk more about in a little bit. Yeah, the Japanese Communist Party is also sort of involved in this, but like, they don't want to let them join for political reasons initially. But you know, the other thing about this, like, it's not just like leftist orgs. Like, Japan's Professional Association for like thespians is in this coalition. Like, yeah, there's, you know, there's a lot of people who are like, there's a lot of groups that are like not inherently political groups that are in this. And
interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, this is the product of like all the stuff the left has been doing for the past, basically since the war like ended. And so, you know, and these guys point out that, you know, so Kishi is able to get the clause out about the U.S. interfering to suppress riots and civil wars, but there's still a clause that says the U.S. is allowed to send troops to deal with, quote, all threats to Japan's peace and security, which, you know, yeah.
Threats to peace and security, like people doing politics we don't agree with.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
This is going to end well, sure.
So the People's Council starts staging these like enormous protests. And, you know, they go on for a few months. It doesn't really do anything until Zengokuren, who is the radical student organization, goes rogue. And the important thing about Zengokuren is that, like, so A, they're not directly tied to any of the parties, and B, they are like way more willing to fight the cops than anyone else here. Mm-hmm. And so the People's Council is planning this like massive series of protests. But Zengokuren looks at, like, you know, this is like their eighth giant protest. And Zengokuren goes, okay, well, those did nothing. So this one's not going to do anything either. So they form a plan to storm the Japanese parliament building. And you know, the People's Council, like, finds out about this plan, and they're like, trying to stop Sengoku-ren from doing it. But Sengoku-ren, like, negotiates with, like, the Tokyo's, like, trade unions, and they're able to just do it anyways. So, you know, 500,000 people across Japan and, like, 80,000 people in Tokyo show up to this protest. And, like, in the middle of the march, Sengoku-ren just, like, charges the police barricades, beats back the police, and, like, forces their way into the Diet and takes control of it. And, you know, they hold it for, like, a day and they leave. And people do not like this. Like, even, like, the Socialists and the Japanese Communist Party, like, condemn them for it. And, you know, public opinion turns against them, and there's this whole, like, disaster. And, you know, and Sengoku-ren gets, like, a lot of shit for this because, you know, like, they stormed the Diet building. But, you know, it's worth remembering that, like, everyone else, like, everything else the more moderate faction was doing just, like, didn't work. And what Sengoku-ren did here was drew an enormous amount of attention to the movement. And this is it. And, you know, that's a vital part of, like, what happens next. And what happens next is that the Socialist Party does, like, I think, like, the funniest set of political tricks I've ever seen in my life, where, you know, like, they have this whole thing they want to do where they're trying to delay the vote, because I think if they delay the vote fast enough, like, long enough, Kishi will just, like, get, like, kicked out of the prime ministership by his own party. And, you know, and this, they're able to drag this on until, like, 1960. And Kishi, like, you know, he, like, Kishi's own party won't let him do a floor vote on the bill because, like, they're mad at him. And so on April 4th, 1970, he creates the Anpo Special Special Measures Committee from loyal LDP members, which was called nicknamed the Anpo Kamikaze Squad, which is, you know, this is his attempt to try to figure out, like, how to, like, get through all of, like, get this, like, treaty through before his support collapses and, like, the Diet session ends. And, like, literally the day the session is going to end and he's going to lose his opportunity to force his vote through, he starts doing his plan. And the Socialist Party, like, knows something's bad is going to happen. So they hire a bunch of, like, quote unquote secretaries who they hire them and they bring them in the building and they barricade the office of the Speaker of the lower house to keep him from leaving his office, which is something that, like, I wish, like, our politicians were like, it's like, man, our politics is, like, our parliament's so boring. Like, nobody's barricading the Speaker of the House, like, in their office.
Yeah.
It's very sad. You know, and the Speaker, like, tells them to move, and they don't. And so he calls the police to remove the Socialist Diet members by force. And this is a huge deal. Like, this is the second time ever that the police have ever entered the Diet chamber. And it's the only time before or since they've ever, like, physically removed Diet members. And so, you know, this whole thing's being like broadcast on live TV. And there's the police just, like, dragging these, like, parliament members out of this building, like, kicking and screaming. And, like, you know, and they catch, like, the Speaker, like, fighting his way to the rostrum. And he calls a vote to extend the Diet session, like, 2 minutes before it's supposed to end. And, like, he wins the vote. And there's the camera. The camera is, like, It pans and it shows all the LDP, like, ministers clapping, and then it pans to the other half of the Diet, and in the other half of the Diet, every single person in the opposition is gone. There's none of them are there. And because the opposition is completely gone, Kishi makes this, like, unexpected snap vote to force a treaty through with no debate. And, you know, and because of some, like, legal bullshit, he's able to figure out a way that, like, the treaty will still go into effect even without the upper house approving it, as long as they just stay in session. And the Japanese public, like, just, they're unbelievably pissed off. Like, even the pro-treaty people look at, like, the ex-fascist guy, like, removing the opposition party by force and holding a previously unknown snap vote with,
right,
no debate.
Yeah.
Yeah. they watch, like, all of this is just on TV. And it, like... like, it sets off three general strikes. And, you know, and at this point, the protests basically become an anti-Kishi movement. And, like, everyone in the country, like, including, like, the conservative newspapers are calling for him to resign. Like, the business leaders turn on him to the point where, like, they start funding Sengoku-ren. Like, they start funding the communist student movement through, like, weird organized crime people because they're, like, Sengoku-ren's mainstream faction is anti-Kishi. Like... yeah. Yeah, that's how, like, wild this, and, you know, and like, the other thing is, like, other, like, ordinary people just, like, start showing up to protests, and so, like, 30 million people, which is, like, a third of the total population, shows up to, like, an anti-Kishi protest between 1959 and 1960.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's, like, it it pisses off everyone. And this is the defining event of like the sort of like the immediate post-war generation. Like this is the thing they remember. So we'll get to this in a little bit, but Shinzo Abe, who was the longest serving Japanese prime minister, he mm-hmm. came out of office like last year. So he's Kishi's grandson. And he talks about he learned politics like while he was on Kishi's knee and Kishi was telling him about what was happening in the streets.
Oh, I bet that was fine.
It's not great. And this part though is extremely funny. Like there's a great story about just like this kindergartner like on the street who asked the famous political scientist Ishida Takashi, why doesn't Kishi just resign already? Like he's good lost question. The kindergartners.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and the other thing that's happening with this is that so Eisenhower is supposed to show up in Japan on the 19th, so he can be there for the 21st, which is he's coming to this giant visit that's it's supposed to be like the 100th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the US and Japan. And this is also the treaty goes into effect. And so, you know, on June 4th, there's the largest general strike in Japanese history. And then on the 15th, there's another general strike that has 6.4 million people in it. And at this strike, you know, a bunch of like street performers, artists and writers like go to like give a petition to parliament, and they all get attacked by this like giant fascist mob with like wooden poles with nails in them. And the mob's just chanting, like, we will kill you and beat them dead.
Jesus.
And, yeah. And, like 80 people are injured. And again, like these are like theater actresses. Yeah.
Classic fascism stuff. Yeah.
Yep. It's like, yes, we will beat these theater actresses and poets, and this will make us strong.
Yeah, that scans.
Yeah, and so 11 people are injured, and 80 people are injured, and 11 people get hospitalized. And meanwhile, Sengoku Ren is like, we're gonna storm the Diet again, and
it worked the last time.
Yeah, well, but the funny thing is, this time it does work, and it works because so they fight the cops for a long time, and it's kind of a stalemate, and the cops do this counterattack. But in this counterattack, they trample a Tokyo University undergrad named Kamba Michiko to death. Oof. And that causes the crowd to just like go wild because, you know, the police just trampled a child to death.
Yeah.
And so 4,000 students storm the Diet, and they hold it until 1 a.m. in these like running street battles with the police. And this is where like everyone turns on Kishi.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the combination of the cops like murdered a girl and they beat up a bunch of theater actresses is mm-hmm. just too much. And at this point, it becomes clear that, you know, if Eisenhower comes to Japan, they won't be able to keep him safe.
Right.
Because they can't hold the streets.
Yeah, that could be a little bit of a faux pas for Japan.
Yeah. You know, and Kishi like really wants this to happen because like the Eisenhower visit in the treaty, like this is everything he's been working for since he became prime minister. And so he has this plan to like mobilize the self-defense forces, which is what the Japanese army is called.
Yeah.
Because euphemisms. Yeah, but he tries to like he has this plan to like mobilize an entire division of like the army and march them through the streets to clear the streets and get Eisenhower in. And even his defense chief and the head of the national police is like, you can't do this. Like there will literally be an uprising. And so Kishi undeterred is like, okay, so I'm gonna go to my Yakuza contacts. So he goes to Kodama and he has this plan to get 18,000 like Yakuza hardliners, like 10,000 guys who work for Yakuza, like street vendors, and 10,000 like veterans, right wing cult members to clear the streets. And like he's going to give them like the government's going to give them like trucks and like food and first aid teams and like command posts and $2.3 million and like airplanes and helicopters.
Oh, that couldn't end badly. Sure.
Yeah. Well, and even his cabinet is like, Kishi, you can't do this. Like, you're going to start a civil war.
Again, and a lot of fascists being like, boy, seems like that's too much fascism.
Yeah, yeah. Kishi is the fascist that other fascists are like, whoa, hey now, like, this is too much fascism.
But you know what's not too much fascism, Chris?
Unless it's a Black Rifle Coffee ad, then.
Unless it's another Black Rifle Coffee ad or an ExxonMobil ad. Or, it's true. One of those weird Christian cult ads we've been kind of getting.
A literal ad for the California Highway Patrol.
Yeah, definitely an ad for chips. That's fascism. So I don't know.
There could be fascism,
I've lost the point that I was trying to make here.
We don't endorse the fascist ads, but it's time for ads, and we're sorry if it's something random we didn't select, and it's horrifying.
We do apologize. We live in an engine of pain. Mm-hmm. Here's some ads. Good stuff. Well, we had some ads. All right, I want to hear how this all gets resolved now that this guy's been like, what if we twist that fascism dial up to 11? And all of his friends were like, that kind of seems a little bit high, because it seems like we've pissed everybody off with all of the violence we've been doing.
Yeah,
it ends, I'm not going to say well, but, Kishi eventually backs down. And is just like, okay, Eisenhower, like, if you come, we can't protect you. And so Eisenhower cancels his visit. And on the day of the treaty supposed to be ratified, 300,000 people show up around the Diet in Tokyo. But, they can't actually stop the treaty from being ratified. And so, because the treaty is being ratified automatically, there's nothing they can do. And so they stand there and, it's this very sort of grim scene. Everyone's wearing black armbands and, black bandanas to celebrate, to sort of mourn, the death of a protester. But, there's nothing they can really do. And, the next day, there's this general strike, and there's, some more protests the day after. But Kishi has the final document he needs to sign, smuggled to him in a candy box so it couldn't be stolen by protesters.
Nice.
Yeah, and so he signs it, and, the next month, on July 15th, Kishi is forced to resign, and the movement just collapses. So, ooh. It's a mixed bag. On the one hand, they got Kishi. This is the only consequence that Kishi is ever going to face in his entire life. That's not quite true. It's one of exactly two consequences he's ever going to face in his entire life, and he survives both of them. But on the other hand, this treaty still went through. And, the sort of left that had built up to stop this becomes incredibly demoralized, and they splinter and fragment, and yeah. And Kishi, because this is the end of Kishi's, mainstream political career. But, he doesn't go away. He sort of stays around behind the scenes as this, it's kind of like this fixer. And, he does a few more things at the end of the war.
Yeah, he sounds like he's kind of Nixoned a little bit, where he's got some soft influence, but also nobody wants to really be seen in public with the guy.
Yeah. Well, okay, I will say there are a few people who do want to be seen in public with this guy. And the biggest of those is called the Unification Church, which is this
Oh, shit.
Yeah. This fanatically anti-communist religious cult. Yeah, that allegedly kidnaps and brainwashes children.
Allegedly. Definitely.
Yeah, and Kishi, Kishi is the guy responsible for bringing these people into the LDP's base, and the head of this party is a guy named Moon, and he gets convicted of tax fraud in the 90s or in the 80s and 90s. But there's a thing in Japan he gets convicted in the U.S. and there's a thing in Japanese law where if you've been convicted of a crime, you can't enter the country. Now, so this should have stopped Moon from coming to Japan. But the vice president, even in the 90s, the Moonies are still so firmly embedded in the LDP that even in the 90s, the vice president of Japan personally intercedes and allows them to enter the country illegally. And it's ooh, great. This is what Kishi's doing in his sort of last
rad
days. Yeah. And, one other thing. One very weird thing happens at the very end of this, which is that the day before he resigns, Kishi's at this dinner gala, and this dude stabs him six times. And then he gives this extremely weird quote that was it's something like, I stabbed him six times, but if I was trying to kill him, he would be dead. And there's all this, and nobody actually knows why he tried to assassinate Kishi or didn't try to assassinate him, instead just stabbed him six times. There's a lot of theories. The guy was an old fascist from the 30s. He was 60 at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And, his stated response was that he talked to the family of the girl that had died. But that doesn't make any sense, because this guy's a fascist. And there's another theory that this is a Yakuza hit. Because Bamako Ono was pissed off that Kishi wouldn't help him be prime minister. So he was just like, okay, I'll send a guy to stab you. I don't know. There's a lot of very weird theories about this, but, you know, it's sort of unclear what happens. And, you know, Kishi survives this. And, you know, even though the LDP, like, is now Kishi-less, quote unquote, the structures and political organizations that he put in place are, you know, they're still here to this day. And that brings us to Kishi's grandson, Shinzo Abe, the longest serving prime minister in Japanese history, who finally left office last year because of an ulcer in his rectum, which, you know.
Critical support to his rectum ulcer.
Oh, man.
Yep.
Oh, gosh.
Now, Abe.
It's not good when I laugh in unison with Robert.
Sometimes good things happen to good people.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
Now, Abe is a member of a group called Nippon Kagai, which is a fascist group that, according to a U.S. congressional report, believes that, quote, Japan should be applauded for liberating much of East Asia from Western colonial powers, that the 1946 and 1948 Tokyo war crimes tribunals were illegitimate, and that the killings by Japanese troops during the 1937 Nanjing massacre were exaggerated or fabricated. And they also openly call for a restoration of the monarchy and the institution of Shinto as a state religion. And Abe himself has, like, repeatedly stated that Japanese military sex slaves, he used the term comfort women because, you know, the euphemisms help him do nihilism, but he, sure. You know, he like, has said on multiple occasions that these sex slaves were never forced to be raped.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's okay. Great. Cool dude. Yeah, no, bad guy. Sweet.
Yeah, and, you know, and he's also a big champion. He's, the champion of, like, so one of Kishi's, like, other signature issue when he was a politician was rearming Japan because he was pissed off that, like, Japan couldn't still be a, like, and when I say rearming, I don't mean defense force. Like, he wants Japan to
he
be
wants
able to
Japan
war
to
again.
To have an effective military that can invade shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He wants to be an empire again. And yeah. Abe's also, like, a giant rearmament person.
Sure.
And
ABR, you know, baby.
And, yeah. And he also visits something called there's a shrine called the Yasukune Shrine, which is this shrine to, like, soldiers who died serving the Japanese emperor. And, you know, the shrine has this thing called the Book of Souls, which, like, has the name of, like, everyone who died, like, serving for the emperor or whatever. There's, like, 2 million people in it. Now, in this book are 1,068 people who were convicted of war crimes and also the 14 Class A war criminals who died and were executed, who are also considered martyrs. And this includes Tojo. And it's you know, now for very obvious reasons, China and Korea and both the Koreas, this is like the one of the few things both Koreas like really completely agree on, is that they get absolutely pissed off about prime ministers visiting their shrine, visiting, you know, a shrine to the people who enslaved, raped and murdered tens of billions of their people. But, you know, Abe did it anyways, because modern Japan is Kishi's Japan. Despite the protests, despite the strikes, despite a third of the country taking to the streets, he won. The only thing he didn't get was rearmament, and so, you know, the mass rapes in Korea and Vietnam would be left to the Americans, not the Japanese. But we all now live in the world that Kishi created.
Cool.
Yeah. All right, Robert.
What a happy story you told us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I promised at the beginning of this episode that at the end of the episodes I would ask you, is this the worst rehabilitation of a fascist war criminal?
In terms of, like, the actual amount of power he got. Probably. Yeah, I think probably. Because, yeah, you've got, like, guys like Von Braun, but, like, Von Braun was bad and it's fucked up that he got rehabilitated. But the thing he went on to do wasn't bad. It was helping to put a man on the moon, which is, like, fine. And you've got, I don't know, there's that Nazi general who the CIA used to set up a spy ring, and he did some fucked up stuff, but I think certainly had less geopolitical influence than this guy. Yeah, I think this is definitely, I'm racking my brain, but I'm not coming up with one to top it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Woo.
Yeah.
Should have started this episode with what's rehabilitating my fascists.
That would have been better.
That would have been a probe.
Mm-hmm. And it turns out the what is my government. Yeah. You love to see it. Well, Chris,
is that the entire thing?
Yeah. What are you, Chris?
I don't feel
you,
good about that, to be honest.
What are you?
Not a good tale.
What you,
I don't either.
What do you think Nicolas Cage's hair smells like?
Nicolas Cage's hair.
Yeah, what I do you think like... his hair smells like? I've been looking at a picture of him for the last 3 hours.
that explains so much. Chris, I have a guess.
I don't think it smells very good because, like, you know, isn't Nicolas Cage like constantly? Good. Okay. Well, because isn't he constantly like doing bad movies because he needs money for his like? Isn't he like an elephant habit? He's like some weird.
No, he's addicted to buying dinosaur skulls.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Okay, I think his hair smells like nail polish remover with a hint of poop.
See, I was gonna say fake apples. But like the specific fake apple smell that they put in like agricultural products, like medicine for horses, like ivermectin fake apples.
That's fair. Hint of poop.
I don't know. We'll see. If you've smelled Nicolas Cage, hit us up on social media. Let us know. Tell us who's right. One of us has to be.
I think you might be right, though. I think it might smell like that really bad apple flavored like alcohol. Also.
Yeah, a little bit of that. A little bit of that.
Hint of poop.
All right. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Someone out there has smelled Nicolas Cage's hair, and they'll let us know who's right.
Let us know. That's really, really what we're.
That way, we're not just.
Robert,
we're
why
not
have
just
you been staring at a photo of Nicolas Cage for 3 hours? Let's get back to that.
Because it's been a long day, Sophie. Everybody needs something to perk them up.
6 hours before
the halfway point. Look, at the midway point of the day, some people have another cup of coffee. Some people stare wordlessly at a photograph of Nicolas Cage while their friend talks about war crimes for 3 hours.
Chris, where can people follow you?
You can follow me being extremely depressed about this at itmechr3 on Twitter. Yeah. If you want to read a slightly less depressing thing that I wrote, I wrote a piece for Lausanne that's like about Tiananmen, which... I swear is less depressing than this, if only sort of marginally. I work for Cool Zone now, so I'm on.
Yeah, expect a lot of Chris.
A lot of other things.
Yeah.
Yep. You can't get rid of me now.
Nope.
So have a good day, and remember, tell us what Nicolas Cage's hair smells like.
Yep.